Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkar, and more importantly, I have the pleasure today of welcoming to the podcast Brian Campbell, who is, along with Dr. Ben Williams, responsible for rendering accessible to us online a translation of the Chidvilasa Stava of Amritananda. Now we'll talk more about what this text is and why it's important. But first, Brian, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Raj, for having me on. It's a pleasure to speak with you and to talk about the Chidvilasa Stava project, very close to my heart, and that I feel very fortunate to work on, especially with Dr. Ben Williams.
So this text, tell us a little bit about this text and where is it from?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's a short text. It's just 40 verses. And it comes from the pen of Amritananda, also known as Amritananda Yogin, Amritananda Natha. He has a couple of names that he goes by, but he's one of the famous early Sri Vidya Acharyas, right? And he's probably most well known for his commentary on the Yogini Hridaya Tantra. He wrote a commentary entitled Deepika. And he's only, you know, one of very few people who's actually managed to write an entire commentary on the Yogini Hridaya Tantra, which does get conflated and put together with the Nitya Shodashi Karnava Tantra, also known as the Vamageshwari Mata, later by other acharyas. But there's only a few acharyas, really, I think five that we have access to, who've actually managed to write an entire commentary. So he's a very important acharya, and he's quite prolific as well. And so this is a very short text of his, just 40 verses. So it's a little bit harder to understand because he doesn't really explain quite a lot of what he's talking about. So it definitely has to be read in tandem with other texts of his. But it's on the contemplation of ritual. Maybe you could say esoteric contemplation of ritual even. So that's kind of where it comes from. And it was just a super interesting text. Kind of hard to even imagine that it hadn't been translated fully before. It's so important, I feel. It's cited all the time by other people as well. And it was just kind of one of the texts that was just sitting there. And it was just like, wow, this is something that we should put some serious attention to. And of course, we were definitely not the first people to put attention to it. Professor Sanderson had already translated a few verses of it. Professor Tim Olsina, Stanish Raji, had already translated a brief summary of it. And Professor Padu has also translated a couple of verses as well. But a full comprehensive look at it hadn't been done before.
Do you suspect that that is because the text mostly exists within the life of practice and hasn't particularly been used in scholarship as much? Like, you know, it is a question. Why would the text not have been translated before? That is surprising to me. It's a very rich text.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just one of those unfortunate things, I think, that happens in the Sri Vidya community. You know, we don't have much translated at all. So the Mula Shastra, for example, has only been translated once, and it's not really the most robust or comprehensive translation. That's, of course, the Nitya Shodashi Karnava Tantra. Yogini Hridaya Tantra was translated by Professor Padu. But other than that, you know, no one from the community per se, you know, into the mandalis, the actual initiated practitioners, has translated it. So I don't know why Sri Vidya texts are just not really translated that much. It's a great question. I think we're starting to see more of them translated, though, perhaps into the future. And I think we could probably say one part of it is that these are secret texts. These are texts which are practiced within mandalis, like you said. These are practical texts. These are upasana padatis. These are, you know, secret teachings that are transmitted from the guru to the disciples. And for the large part, you know, the mandalis are quite independent. You know, they operate on their own. They have their own guru parampara, their own guru lineage. And they come together sometimes for inter-mandali communications and things like that. But generally, not so much. I think through history, it's more of a private matter. Perhaps one of the greatest Sri Vidya luminaries of the last 100 years, you know, Chidananda Nathar of the famous Guhananda Mandali, he was actually the first person to put together Sri Chakra Puja Paddati, right, in 19, whatever it was, 30 or something. And he says in the introduction to this great work that he did is that you know, all the mandalis have a different padati. They're full of errors. Nobody knows, you know, exactly what's going on. So I'm taking it upon myself to look at all of the different padatis that he could find and kind of make a critical addition, if you will, as we would say in the academic world. So, and that only happened, you know, less than 100 years ago. So it's just, we're just barely touching the beginning of Sri Vidya coming into the light more, away from just, you know, siloed mandalis, you know.
Yeah, and I think perhaps it's important to reflect on the notion of esoteric tradition, and this is difficult, I think, for many laypersons and most certainly even many scholars of South Asia to fully grok where that there are teachings and texts available within public discourse, and there are no shortage of teachings that one can only get upon an initiation, and they sort of run side by side. So in a sense, the text hasn't been translated into English because there isn't, until relatively recently, a tradition of staunch interest and even initiation among sadhakas in the Anglosphere. Whereas the text may be used day in and day out among sadhakas or practitioners. And I think that's perhaps a tension or sort of a parallel reality worth paying attention to.
Absolutely. I mean, we wouldn't even have this text if it wasn't for, you know, Professor Dwivedi, who published it openly in Sanskrit. Before that, it was in manuscript form only. And so, yeah, I mean, we took a chance, of course, publishing such a esoteric and, you know, in many ways, secret text openly in English for the benefit of the entire Sri Vidya community. But, you know, we consulted with our gurus first and we got their blessings. And we feel that Professor Dwivedi was the first to really bring it out into the open through his publication. And so we're following in his footsteps. And there's a couple of lines, you know, scattered throughout Raj. Even Shivananda Muni, the, you know, a couple generations, maybe one generation before Amritananda, has, you know, potent lines in there where he kind of hints at the fact that he would love to have this studied and written, studied by people for a long time. So you kind of get this idea that these texts were meant to circulate, you know, throughout time. And so we kind of built on that as our base to say, you know what, yes, we'll take a chance. We'll publish something that perhaps, you know, in many ways is a secret text that maybe shouldn't even have been published in the first place, right? Maybe it should have been kept secret. But we took a chance with the blessings of our gurus and the Guru Mandala. So, you know, here we are.
Are you aware of extant living traditions engaging the text for sadhana?
Only through a senior practitioner named Sri Ram, who has a manuscript of it, and he was posting, I mentioned him briefly in the introduction, he was posting on it back in 2009. I think he's in Bangalore. I don't know if he's still around. He's no longer active online, but he had a manuscript of it that he received from his guru, and he was obviously very devoted to it, and he was practicing the contemplations. And, you know, it would have been, of course, amazing to reach out to him, to talk to him, to consult with him. But I was never able to get in contact with him. And with a name like Sri Ram, I mean, it'd be very hard to find, you know, Sri Ram. So, yeah, unfortunately. But he's the only one that I know of personally. But I'm sure there must be many more, because I think there was a number of manuscripts that were consulted by Professor Dwivedi when he published his 1985 critical edition of Nityashodashi Karnava Tantra, in which Chidvilasa stuff is in the appendix, along with many other super important and amazing Sri Vidya texts.
For those of us who've had the good fortune of meeting and studying traditional pundits, it is astonishing the extent to which entire texts reside in memory, even absent manuscripts. And so one really and truly gets a sense the extent to which the manuscripts are as if props or sheet music at times. Since there's a vibrant tradition that is in memory. And of course, you know, one can't take prima facie from the scholarly perspective claims of antiquity or claims of anything. But nevertheless, It's the extent to which a text means something incredibly different in this context. The very notion of text functions very differently, but it's nevertheless fascinating and important. You know, one can derive profound riches reading the Bhagavad Gita, and yet until relatively recently, the Bhagavad Gita was never read in its entirety by anyone, ever. It was discussed in a context of an exegetical context with one task with implanting the seeker with the actual the essence, the bhavana, the jnana of the verse. So it's powerful. Nevertheless, whether we take this text as a mysterious relic, or we take it as an aid to spiritual evolution, all of those dimensions may well be true. But it is, in addition to all of that, it is glorious poetry, glorious language. And so, just one verse. I'm just randomly going to pick a verse, because pretty much any verse I pick will be rich. Here you go.
Oh my gosh! Verse four.
Sandhya Vandana. Night bewilders all beings, and day awakens everything. The twilight in which they meet. In this non-dual teaching is the fusion of Shiva and Shakti. The Supreme Goddess herself is indeed the presiding deity of the twilight.
Wow. I mean,
you know, wake up every day and read that and see who you are after a month.
Exactly. Contemplate that for even 2 minutes, slowly. Close your eyes, repeat that for, you know, your consciousness will be changed for sure. And I think that's part of the point of the text, is to change your consciousness and to kind of move into these deep bhavanas that you can really not just read, you know, 1 to 40 verses and put it down and say, yeah, I've read the Chittavalasa Stava, but this is a text that you just revisit constantly and, you know, read one verse, half a verse, a few words, and just, you know, put it down and really contemplate it deeply. It's a beautiful
text. And then on top of the utterly rich ideas, themes, transmissions, if you will, for those of us who are studying Sanskrit or have a bit of Sanskrit or can even blindly read the transliteration. I mean, the music, the cadence, the assonance, and I mean, all of what I just said. There's this beautiful running sibilant energy of this verse in Sanskrit. So it's Sanisha Sakala Loka Mohani Vasara Sakalu Sarvabodhaka. Like, there, you know, you can't, you'll never be able to reproduce the energy of the poetry in Sanskrit. So it's a beautiful product of human ingenuity.
Absolutely. We hope to have it recorded as well, Raj. That's in the plan. To have it recorded
In the Sanskrit or the English or both?
That's a great point. It was originally just the Sanskrit. We wanted to have it recited in the Sanskrit as a beautiful kind of offering, but we haven't finished that part of the project yet. But in English would be interesting. You know, there's someone on YouTube who actually does a lot of this non-dual stuff, and she recites different things. I forget her name. I think she was a nun for a while. And she recites very slowly radical non-dual poetry and texts. And she's extremely famous. So maybe you could reach out to her and say, hey, look, here's another text, and feel free. Because it is open access, you know, so we don't want any money from it. Maybe she would be interested. That's a great idea.
Well, that's another point that I mentioned at the outset, is that this text is open access. If you're remotely interested in what we're talking about, just click the link in the podcast notes, and it's yours free of charge. Above and beyond being a scholar of Sanskrit narrative, I've been blessed to have engaged put on different ways, and I have an online school which consists of sort of hybrid sort of scholarship and spiritual teachings. It's a hybrid form of education, and there's so many insights that are shared regarding the symbology of the goddess and Shakti and the play of Shakti, insights about masculine and feminine and Ida and Pingala and lunar and solar. And I'm looking through this text and I'm thinking, okay, they no longer have to, you know, for those who are intent on wanting a source, I can say, look, what I've been telling you for 2 years, look at this verse on Surya Puja of the stacks. This is, you know, it's hard for people to grok that the text is on the tongue, that it's baked into the lineal training. But now I can point and say, look, here's a text that talks about the play of Shiva and Shakti.
Yeah. several friends, several Upasikas who have reached out to me have said the same thing. Like, we knew a lot of this stuff. We've been trained by our gurus, but we never had a text. We couldn't point to it. And, it, you know, just, you know, it was just like that. Even some priests, even swamis have reached out and told me the same thing. Like, finally, we have a text that we can point to. So I think it was an unintended consequence that people
point to for those in our culture who, because of various historical trajectories and biases, value text and look to text and think that text comes first and tradition comes from text. Whereas in the Indic context, it's very much text is the residue of long-standing tradition.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. And this is so, so difficult for folks to grok. But yeah, for those who need these teachings in a text, it was just serendipitously. I was looking at this interplay and I was teaching just the other day at the Indian Wisdom School. That's the platform I founded. That's the hybrid. That's the only place I really teach spiritually publicly. Everywhere else I do continuing studies in more of an Edic outsider context. Mm-hmm. And I was teaching on breath, and I was teaching on the channels, Ida and the Pingala, and the interplay. And they were asking about Shakti. Well, then who is Shakti? Is she Ida? Is she Pingala? And I'm like, no. Well, Adi Shakti Shushumna. You know, we're engaging in these ideas. And the vast majority of students are, what's being said resonates, or they can compute it, so it makes sense to them. But every once in a while, where's that from?
Right.
And that's from Parampara. Like, yeah. Oh, I don't know what to tell you. Where's that from? Or I'll tell a version of a myth, a vignette, a tale, and the tale may well be in the Puranas or in the epics, right? But the tale may be told in a way that I've heard it that doesn't quite accord. There's a book called The Stories Behind the Poses. Some other renditions don't exist anywhere else in print,
yeah,
because they're just the way that I heard it.
Yeah,
and so difficult for people to wrap their mind. What do you mean that's the way you heard it? You know. Yes. Well, okay. So we're going to look at the story of the churning of the ocean. Where's this from? Well, it's from a number of places.
Yeah.
So which one will we prioritize? But all of those places are not the source of the tradition of telling the story. They're just the trail of breadcrumbs left behind by the tradition telling the story.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of students don't, you know, necessarily want to put in the time and energy and effort to, you know, learn about manuscriptology and the transmission of texts and manuscripts and the printing press and the historical factors that all go into play. So it could be a bit difficult for people, but at least if anyone pops up and says, hey, where is this in a text, you can say, well, here you go, Chidvilasastapa.
what is your favorite aspect or verse or elements of this text?
Oh my gosh, the really the whole thing. I mean, the favorite verse, you know, gosh, I think towards the end, the verse, the Visarjana verse, I think is one of the most powerful verses for me, as well as I think for many Upasikas. That, of course, is the verse that talks about the disappearance of the Sri Chakra, right? As a form, let me actually pull it up here. Oh, yes, verse 39, Visarjana, right? Translation, of course, Dr. Ben Williams. The majesty of that innate nature is imagined to be a chakra of divine energies, like a snake is mistaken for a rope. The disappearance of that chakra as a result of awakening to the ultimate truth of that same innate essence is the ultimate form of ritually inviting the deity to depart. So in my mind, I mean, I've contemplated this verse quite a lot, and some of my friends as well, practitioners, we also thought, God, we should have a really amazing picture here with a snake and a Sri Chakra and kind of disappearing, right? Like kind of like smoke, or maybe just residue, like you said, residual Sri Chakra disappearing into light. Anyways, it's just one of my favorite verses. It's just so profound, because Sri Vidya, of course, is a highly ritualized system of worship. Perhaps one of the most, I would say, I would dare to say, maybe one of the most ritualized. I mean, Sri Vidya Upasikas are known for lengthy pujas. They're known for being masters of all kinds of mantras. The pujas go on and on. I mean, Sri Chakra Navavarana, the puja, could perhaps be one of the most complicated pujas that's currently being done, you know, not even publicly, but, you know, sometimes publicly. Needlessly to say, I mean, very complicated and very ritually oriented. So to have a verse from Amartananda, of all people, that says, you know, Sri Chakra will disappear like a snake. it's super powerful. And I think it's a really potent and powerful reminder for all Upasakas to really remember that that the thing that we're worshiping, the Sri Chakra, or even sometimes, you know, all the ritual utensils, all the things that we worship, will disappear, right? That puja and that ritual will transform itself into higher level, actually, maybe not higher level, higher is the wrong word, esoteric contemplation, maybe even, you know, I struggle for words, Raj, because I don't really like the inner and outer too much, you know, inner meaning, outer meaning, even though it has a lot of precedence, right? Antaryaga,
material and spiritual, or stula and sukshma, gross and subtle, perhaps.
Yeah, stula, sukshma, you know, para. I'm still kind of grasping and still studying and trying to find out what the right vocabulary is.
There is none.
Thank you. Thank you.
Stop looking. Either explain it in the vocabulary we have, if you're helping to direct people for practice, and then they will taste it, because no words can capture the taste of vanilla. You have to taste vanilla.
Sure, that's true. That's true. But in efforts to try to articulate as best as I possibly could, we'll just say esoteric, or transform into higher contemplative modes, you know, different. Yeah, bias. We can say that. How about that?
Yeah, I'm just thinking aloud, you know, on the podcast, I have a very, very narrow expertise in sort of Sanskrit narrative texts. And, you know, for the most part, I know a thing or two about the Indic world at large, but for the most part, I mean, vast majority of these conversations are with specialists, where I'm, you know, I know just a bit more than a generalist about their area. So in terms of Sri Vidya, I've had a little bit of a look at Sri Vidya, and certainly regarding your comment about ritual, it is exceptionally and exquisitely ritualistic. I think there are other traditions, whether Chandipat, I think there are other traditions that are also vibrantly ritualistic. I think one of the fascinating features of Sri Vidya is the commingling of stringent ritual activity and interiorization and ideation and contemplation. And so it really is this brilliant medley. When we think of the history of Indian religions, or the history of Hinduism, when we think of, you know, a stringent Vedic ritual, and then confronted with this sort of renounce or critique and revolution of wait, no, get, you know, forget the ritual, forget caste, forget society, just go and look inwards and wake up, find a guru. And then we have this brilliant tradition that really is the apex of the commingling of each heritage, where it is very, very ritualistic. But all of that ritual is consciously done with respect to interior affect, having some sort of experience. It is understood that it is not about the physical, but yet the physical world is nevertheless fully embraced and leveraged for spiritual evolution. And so I think there really is a beautiful overlap in Sri Vidya.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Very well said. You know, it's also, yeah, like you said, the apex is a culmination in many ways. I mean, when you start looking into the Sri Vidya text, and, you know, who's Amartananda citing, who's Bhaskaraya citing, who's Shivananda Muni citing in their commentaries? So what are they building on? So you can kind of see that Sri Vidya in many ways is a culmination of many lineages of Kaula Tantra, and many other aspects as well, especially as it travels through different social groups, especially in South India, right? And so it just embodies so much, you know, so many amazing traditions. And see, even you were speaking of the Chandi, right? Many Sri Vidya Mandalis do quite extensive Chandi homams, and you know, so it's just an amazing, very diverse tradition. And that was part of the reason to bring the Chidvilasa stuff out, is that there's so many Sri Chakra Puja manuals. They're all over the place. They're produced regularly, right? Mantric compendiums, are produced regularly. Ritual classes are given regularly. Gurus are there who are accepting people, initiating people, teaching people in India and abroad. But how much of the texts like Chidvilasastava are being produced on a regular basis? And it was just not that many, right? So that was kind of the reason, like, not as a counterweight or anything to the ritualism, because I love ritualism, right? I'm trained in ritualism as well. I studied for many years and I perform ritual and I love it. But we needed a little bit of some of the contemplative aspects as well that we thought, myself and a few other people, and fortunately, Dr. Ben, thought that, you know, this would be a nice little balance to distribute the community to say, hey, we definitely all know that you're doing intense ritual sadhanas, but here's a little something to contemplate as well. That's a little rarer. So I feel lucky to have taken a part of that.
Fascinating. So then would you say this contribution is for practitioners, for scholars, for who would you say would most benefit from this?
Well, initially, you know, it's hard because I'm a former academic. Ben is a full-on academic. The original intention was, let's do something for practitioners alone. Let's not make it too academic. Let's make it practitioner friendly, right? And let's do open access and let's give this as a gift to all the Sri Vidya Mandalis, you know, worldwide international Sri Vidya community. But, you know, it's hard, you know, old habits die hard, right? So as working with Ben, I'm doing it. Now we're doing notes, you know, I'm starting to pull things here and there. So we tried not to make it too academic, but, you know, it's hard to say, hey, let's just pull out all the academic vocabulary and all the academic standards and just do something fully for practitioners when we have such deep history with academics. So we tried our best not to make it too academic and not to make it too intimidating to practitioners who don't know anything about academics, don't know anything about Andre Padu, professor, anyone. And they just are very, very involved in Upasana. Right? This could be a quite intimidating text for them. And we do recognize that. And that was not the goal, to intimidate practitioners who don't regularly study these things. The goal was to really make something accessible for everyone and especially oriented towards the practitioners. I think some academics are definitely interested in it. A few people have reached out. But, you know, it was originally intended for initiated practitioners and devotees as well. But yeah. That's basically who the intended audience was.
Well, part of the real interest to me is that the hybrid nature, in a sense, times are changing. Times are changing, and I'm learning that through my own experiences and my own journey as a teacher, a public educator of various contexts. Mm-hmm. And initially, when I founded the Indian Wisdom School, you know, the three sort of pedagogical components are sort of scholarship, spirituality, for lack of a better word, and storytelling. These are huge components of the brand, of the educational sauce, if you will. And initially, I was a little more sheepish about some of the more esoteric teachings, because I'm used to speaking to educated Western audiences who have a particular worldview. And now what I'm finding more and more is that there are seekers who are very intelligent and studious. So I'm finding more and more that there are some very studious seekers who want both. They want to understand the history and the culture. They want the footnotes, but they also are looking for the experiential, right? So they're sort of, ambidextrous in that sense. So I think it's useful to translate this and annotate this in a way that will serve the scholarly enterprise, because it doesn't take anything away from those using the texts for practice. And if anything, it adds to that dimension. And really for the sadhakas who are using this text, more often than not, they'll be engaging the text with a teacher or someone,
absolutely, yeah,
someone who has a level of attainment or sight or however you want to think of that. And so it's useful for the teacher to point to this. Here are the verses, you know, here's the translation in English. Perhaps the aspirant is coming from the English speaking world, for example. And so, you know, I like the hybridity of the project. The impetus behind it, it resonates for a variety of reasons. And the world has changed. I think there's much more space in academia for practicing life. I think there always was a fair bit of space for practitioners of Abrahamic traditions.
Than a fair amount of space. I mean, go on.
Right. But I mean, for practitioners of Indic traditions, I think it's been a little bit more of an uphill climb, aside from certain strands of Buddhism, which have been sanitized and quote unquote rationalized and sure. accepted as it's, you know, let's, you know, some sort of modern Vulcanism, you know.
Yeah.
But I think now there's more space for there's less prejudice towards individuals who are practitioners and scholars of Indic traditions. Is my, you know, in a sense, I'm an active academic, I guess, in terms of production and collaboration. But by the same token, I'm not at a university. I have teaching affiliations. I don't, you know, I'm not at a university. I don't have a professorship in that sense. So on the one hand, I don't really have a department to refer to. On the other hand, I've spoken to literally hundreds of people and I've gleaned all kinds of insights about what are happening in their departments. And I think there's a number of transformations afoot in the study of religion. And I think one of those transformations is not throwing the baby out with the bathwater and leaving space for practice where it doesn't, such that it doesn't trespass upon the scholarly enterprise, you know,
right.
and they can mutually reinforce each other or illumine each other. So, I've rambled on for far too long. Tell us about this Tripura Telaka platform. Yeah.
This is a group, it's an initiative of a few individuals and myself. And we're just really interested to contribute something to the Sri Vidya community, like we talked about. Not just Chidvilasa stuff, of course. We have a bunch of ideas and things that we would like to do and put out. One, and we got a lot of projects for this year as well. We'll see how many will get completed. Chidvilasa stuff took much longer than we originally anticipated. So we'll see how many we can get completed this year. But we do have one, which I'd like to share, is that we've started doing drawings of all of the deities and the depictions, you know, iconographic depictions of all the deities from the Parashurama Kalpa Sutra. So there's 14 principal deities there. As far as we know, they've never been drawn, right? You can't find them in any books. We've consulted with many professors, especially Professor Bhundaman, right, Gudrun. And, you know, these deities just don't exist. Although dhyana shlokas are there, mantras are there in Nityotsava and in Parashuram Kalpa Sutra, but no one's really drawn them. So we're in the process of having them drawn. And we're super excited about that, to offer that out and say, hey, check it out. Open access. Here are all the 14 principal deities of the Parashuram Kalpa Sutra. Of course, if for the listeners who don't know which text that is, it's a very important ritual compendium for Sri Vidya, especially in South India. Professor Sanderson has mentioned it's probably written in South India, probably in Kanchipuram itself. And so, you know, this is something super interesting because the yantras are there, the descriptions of what the deities look like are there, but, you know, no one has really drawn them. And we looked, of course, like we said, Raj, maybe in Mandalis have those drawings, they have manuscripts, they have that, but they're not being shared openly. So we took it upon ourselves to follow the Dhyanam shlokas there and have them drawn. So super excited about that. So that's a project that's coming out. But the whole initiative of the Tripura Telaka is really to just share things more openly and also to kind of, in a certain sense, put some glue together with the different mandalis, right? So International Sri Vidya Conference has been going on for a few years. Every once in a while, a mandali will put one on and they'll invite all the main gurus, all the senior upasikas from different mandalis, you know, all the way from Gujarat to Kerala to Tamil Nadu to maybe Nepal, you know, all over, pan-Indic, right? But those don't happen all that much. And, you know, there's this tendency to silo out. So we thought, you know what, let's do something for the entire community, of Sri Vidya practitioners. And that was kind of the impetus for the starting the Tripuratalika, to really bring out some new translations, new texts, and new things that we thought were lacking, you know, in our own practice and study, you know.
Loka Sangraha.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, we do pujas, we do, you know, yantra pujas, tarpana, different things to deities of the Parashambhukalpa Sutra. But many of the deities, you know, we don't know what they look like per se, aside from our own visualizations based on the mantras. So we thought that would be an interesting offering. And of course, I tried to make this clear in the introduction, that Chidvalasa stuff as well is for all the work that we're doing. We're not trying to give you definitive meaning or definitions of what the text means or what the deities look like, but we're just trying to add a little something more that wasn't there before, right? So maybe the translation was off. Maybe the notes are off. Maybe the manuscript that Professor Dwivedi had was off and he, you know, changed it according to another interpretation. That's fine. You know, we're definitely not trying to erase any traditions at all. We're just trying to add a little something for people to contemplate and to enjoy as well. I think the enjoyment factor also has to be there, right? What's the reason for drawing Parashambhukalpa Sutra deities? Well, for enjoyment as well, to see them, because we do the mantras, people memorize the mantras, we're doing the pujas, and it's all vibrant and wonderful, but there's a certain enjoyment of having a painting or a picture of a deity, right? So I think that's also part of the Sri Vidya path as well, is enjoyment, right? This is a beautiful path, right? This is Sri, right? This is Sundari. This is the Vidya. So there's an aspect of enjoyment that we also try to tap into with the Tripuratalika.
Well, certainly when engaging Tripura Sundari, playfulness is piety. regarding what you said a moment ago about your attitude towards the text, and that it may well be a work in progress, it is a link in a chain. See, the attitude you take towards the text is befitting the ways in which, quote unquote, texts in Indic traditions functions. They are various textual iterations, are offshoots or condensations of tradition. They're not the source of tradition, right? You don't go back to the text in a dogmatic way and say, well, this is what is printed here, and therefore this is the tradition. So famously or infamously, the Puranas, right? The reception of the Puranas in sort of colonial scholarly world. I mean, took some time to realize that, listen, they're not all corrupt. I mean, this is how the Puranas function. They're dynamic. This is not a bug. This is a feature of the Puranas.
Maybe it was written in not so Pakka Sanskrit. You know, that's a possibility, right? I think tantric studies. Well, you know.
But by maybe, if by maybe you mean definitely, then yes. I wondered about the images that you were. You're about to commission. What criteria, if any, do you have in terms of whom you might approach for such a task, or what would that look like?
Right, absolutely. For things that we can't do in-house, we definitely want to find the people who are best qualified. Ideally, for drawing, we would want someone who's painting, who is a practitioner, who had a sense of how to draw, right? Indic deities. We commissioned Charles Ekabumi Elek, a famous artist and a very talented painter, to do the first one of Mahaganapati. So he drew that one, and we have a few more that we're still looking to finish. And yeah, I mean, the quality is just basically, you know, we're looking for people who are in our world. So, you know, I'm sure that there's many great Sanskritists who would be willing to translate texts, Deepika, Nityashoshi Karnava, many things. But, you know, are they in our world? Are they in our contact list? Do we know them? Would they even be willing to do something open access? I mean, that's also one of the major qualifications as well, is that we want to do something open access. So, you know, a lot of people want to make money as well, and there's nothing wrong in that, but you know, we would have to find someone who'd be willing to work with us on that aspect as well. And that, of course, narrows the list quite a lot, Raj, right? So we started with, 10,000 artists. Now we just said all that. We're looking at like three left now. But we're always looking for help and for people who are interested to help, right? There's a lot of famous and a lot of not so famous artists and Sanskritists and people who are just interested in helping. And so we're always looking for people who are interested to help and who are passionate, really, about the work. I think that might be the biggest qualification. Initiated into Sri Vidya in our Mandali or not, I don't think that's a qualification. Initiated into Sri Vidya itself, I don't even think that's going to be a qualification here. I think maybe initiated into some lineage adjacent or parallel would be highly desirable, of course, but really passionate about the work, I think, might be the most important qualification of people who want to help and work with Tripura Talika.
Well, part of the reason that I asked the question while we're on the podcast here is because perhaps there might be folks listening who may be interested in contributing or may have contacts. And so I imagine that they would be able to reach out to you if so.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're looking for help in different ways. I mean, as well as manuscripts. I know that there's many manuscripts that are sitting with Sri Vidya communities and families. And sometimes the people who hold the manuscripts are not practicing. They're not really into it, but they have the manuscripts. They perhaps don't know what to do with them. A lot of those get donated to places, maybe Mukta Bodha, maybe the Pondicherry, the French Institute there, different mattas, right, in Tamil Nadu. They have a lot of manuscripts. But, sometimes people don't donate them. They just kind of hold them. So we'd be interested to help digitize them, to help preserve them, as well as, if the owners are willing to help, put some life to them and translate them and put them out into a larger audience. So that's just one aspect. I think on the website, we have three main aspects. One was translations, right? So we're interested in doing new translations of Sri Vidya texts. One is text digitization and manuscript work. And so I'm happy to say, Raj, we have 5 e-texts that no one else has, right? So Nada Mukta Bodha, no one else has them. We've done them, and we're going to put them up pretty soon for the benefit of the scholar community and the Upasaka community, for everyone. And then the third thing is the art, bringing out new art. And like I said, the Parashuram Kalpa Sutra deities is the first big project on the art front. But definitely don't want to stop there. We definitely want to bring out more art from the tradition as well, that's just not readily available.
Fantastic. Well, Brian, is there anything else that you wanted to touch on regarding the work, the translation, the platform, anything at all?
No, I mean, I'm just super excited that you invited me to come on and talk about the Chitvilasa Stava, and definitely any of the listeners who are interested to read it. It's available. It's on the website. I think you got the link in the podcast, at tripuratalika.org. Under projects, it's a text that can be contemplated, it can be read, it could be, read one page, you put it down for a year and read another page next year, we're not offended at all. We want people to use it how they see fit, and hopefully the ultimate aim, of course, is to enhance people's practice, right, so that next time that someone's doing Nyasa, or next time someone's doing Surya Pujana, or next time someone's doing Sri Chakra Puja, that maybe a little bit of the Chitvilasa Stava will pop up in their mind when they're doing it, and they'll just sit there and contemplate a little bit. And that would be the ultimate goal, to enhance the practice. So we hope that we've been able to do that. Only time will tell. And only the practitioners will be able to tell if we've been able to do that.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you so much, Raj.
For those listening, we've been talking with Brian Campbell, who along with Dr. Ben Williams has translated a beautiful Sanskrit text into English, the Chitvilasa Stava, or Hymn to the Play of Consciousness. And it's all available open access. Just click the link in the podcast notes. Until next time, keep well, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating the play of consciousness. Take care.